Good morning, everyone. I'm going to go ahead and call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. All right, this is what we got. We got a full day today. We have to be out of here close to 10 o'clock. What I'm going to do is we have four bills that we have scheduled for public hearing. We're going to take them out of order from the way they are on the agenda. And so what we're going to do, we'll start off with Senate Bill 786. We'll next go to Senate Bill 807. There are two remaining bills, Senate Bill 262 and 256. I'm not sure, depending on how much testimony we have on the first two, if we're going to be able to, one, even start on that. Those two, or if we're going to need to carry those over. I've spoken to some of the interested parties, but I want to make sure everyone knows on the record that we may need to carry those over for completion of public hearing on Friday, tomorrow, if we're not able to complete those. My goal for the first two bills is I've tried to limit our testimony for each of those bills to about 25 minutes each. And we're going to see where we go based on what the numbers are of how many people want to be giving testimony. What I'm going to be not only requesting, but let's say requiring, if you have written testimony, I do not, and this committee does not need you to read your testimony into the record. We will read your testimony. What we need you to do is summarize your points that you want to make. So we can capture that and we can move forward. If you're in one of the groups that will be testifying after others have testified and they have raised the points that you agree with, if you could just basically tell us that instead of taking the time to restate. We want to get through as many people as we can. We have a process of those who are over 100 miles away. We'll make sure we get those on the record. I will look at the other two bills, 262 and 256. If we do have people that have traveled over 100 miles, I will open up a hearing before the end of the day to take that testimony. So those individuals will be on the record, and they will be consolidated into any other testimony we take. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and open up the first public hearing, which is on Senate Bill 786. And council?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 786 requires employers to accommodate religious practices of employees and makes violations an unlawful employment discrimination, allows employees to use vacation time, wear religious clothing, and take time off for religious practice. Employers must accommodate unless the accommodation causes undue hardship, lists factors for considering hardship, requires school district, clarifies the school district does not commit unlawful employment practice by prohibiting teachers from wearing religious clothing while teaching. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. First, I want to start with the panel of the Speaker of the House, Dave Hunt, and Boley Secretary, or Commissioner, excuse me, Brad Avakian. And gentlemen, did you have someone else that you wanted to come up with you?
Senator.
Oh, I'm sorry. Dave, thank you very much. I didn't see you there. If you all three would go ahead and come on up. And then while you're getting situated, looking at the other people that are signed up to testify, it looks like four of the individuals are with the Northwest Religious Liberty Association. I hope that you will consider my comments as to consolidating the statements so each of you are not saying exactly what everyone else has said. Thank you. Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Representative Dave Hunt. Appreciate you scheduling a hearing on this issue. This is one of those issues where we clearly have a challenge. And as I was looking at some recent federal statistics, it's clear that based on some Supreme Court decisions from the early 90s that we've got a real challenge with increasing numbers of claims of religious discrimination in the workplace and elsewhere. The statistics at the federal level between 1992 and 2007, the claims of religious discrimination filed with the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission more than doubled, going from 1,388 up to 2,880. And the federal government, as these court decisions came down, has come in and addressed the protection of religious free exercise in some specific areas. Land use, institutionalized persons dealing with the free exercise of religion in prisons, they have not yet dealt with protection of religious free exercise in the workplace. And so I think this bill, Senate Bill 786, gives us an opportunity to do that in a very narrowly targeted way. This bill is not focused focused on a broad approach to religious free exercise protection. There are other areas where I think, frankly, we need to come back in the future and zero in on other specific areas where there are problems. But the work, much as the federal government found that land use was a problem, which they've now addressed, and free exercise in prisons was a problem, which they've now addressed, religious free exercise in the workplace is an issue of ongoing concern. This issue, you'll see in Senate Bill 786 that the focus is just on two areas within the workplace. Protecting leave so employees can legitimately observe their religious practice, and that they can appropriately wear religious clothing that is consistent with their religion. The standards, you'll notice the standard of reasonable accommodation. Employers must give reasonable accommodation to religious free exercise in the workplace unless it meets an undue hardship standard. Now those, I'm not an attorney, most of you are. Those standards don't actually mean some of you are, sorry. Most of those.
Rick Novo, Mr. Speaker.
I just insulted some of my committee members who aren't lawyers.
Those two standards, reasonable accommodation and undue hardship, are terms, as some of the experts who follow will make very clear, have great grounding in federal and state law, have great grounding in constitutional precedent. And in fact, if you look at Oregon statute, we've modeled the exact language that's listed in Senate Bill 786 based on the standard that we already have in statute for protecting workers based on disability. Employers must accommodate employees in the workplace based on their disability unless they meet an undue hardship, exactly as it's defined here in this bill. I think the experts that follow will focus on the fact that we've got a series of claims that have arisen because we have 2 weeks of an accommodation based on the Supreme Court decisions at the federal level that have thrown out some previously higher protections. So I think this is a reasonable bar. The goal here is not to put an unfair burden on businesses. The goal is not to increase litigation or increase complaints. The goal here is really to make it clear to employees that they do have the freedom to freely exercise their religion, recognizing there's an undue hardship standard on businesses that gives business owners some protection, and to send a clear signal to employers that they need to accommodate that, provide reasonable accommodation, unless and until it meets that undue hardship standard. I should also note that we have reached out to several business organizations and got some specific feedback from Associated Oregon Industry. We're confident we'll be able to accommodate at least some of their concerns in some amendments to the bill. We're working with them on that. And with that, I will yield to my colleagues.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and the committee members. My name is David Nelson, State Senator from District 29. I'm on this bill as a sponsor of the bill. I felt there were significant enough issues that it deserved a hearing and could be fleshed out and see what the concerns were from both sides. And so that's going to be the extent of my testimony and let the real experts understand. I just felt that there were significant enough issues here that we ought to be talking about.
Mr. Chair, I'm Brad Avakian, State Labor Commissioner. As such, I lead the state's Bureau of Labor and Industries. The Bureau is the state's chief law enforcement agency for protecting Oregonians' civil rights on the job, in housing, and in public places. And when this bill becomes law, it's the Bureau that will enforce it. We are very supportive of this bill. I think it's a carefully crafted bill to find a balance between protecting the rights of individuals and the needs of Oregon's businesses. Oregon currently has a law that protects people from discrimination based on religious grounds. The law is inadequate to extend right now to the issue of free exercise in the workplace. That is a, as you know, a tried and true staple of this country's rights through the Constitution. The First Amendment, of course, prohibits infringing upon somebody's free exercise of religion. But the First Amendment only applies to government action, not to private action. And Oregon currently does not have a law that relates to private action. This will fill that void, and because of that, it's very appropriate for you to pass this law now. I would mention that we had at the Bureau 48 complaints of religious discrimination last year. If you go over the last decade, we have had well over 500 complaints of discrimination. So there certainly is a need for us to make sure that our law covers all possible circumstances. We believe this bill does that. Lastly, Mr. Chair, the Speaker is right that the section relating to the undue hardship test is something that currently exists in disability law in Oregon. I would add it also exists in wage and hour law and a number of other areas of current employment law. It is a standard that has been used in this state for many years to create a balance between the needs of Oregon's industries and the need to protect individual rights. It is a test that has been very successful in accomplishing that and is appropriate for this bill as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Let me see if there's any questions on Senator Boquist first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And question of counselor and commissioner there. Let the speaker off. Not opposed or supportive either way. I mean, it sounds like a fine bill, but the question jumps out at me. Two things jump out, and it's the educational exemption. I mean, the first thing that jumps out is, does the existing law, and I think it does, and would this actually be creating a special class which would be challengeable because we're saying teachers don't have this right? And the second thing related to that is academic freedom. And the reason I raise it, I didn't know what the existing law said, no teacher in any public school shall wear so on and so forth, because I know this, the university system has had this argument before and allows professors to wear whatever religious clothing they have. And I specifically remember one case when the Bhagwan Rajneesh, right? When his supporters, who were many were college professors, you know, were wearing their stuff to school, this whole issue came up, and it was addressed then not as religious but as academic freedom since they were professors. So how does this contradict with what we're doing now, and are we opening ourselves up to creating a special class that's challengeable?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, let me make a more general comment with respect to that. I think the Speaker then wants to give you something more specific, but it's well established in the law that when we're dealing with public entities, that there is, which of course a school would be, that there is more discretion, you have more discretion in limiting individual rights in those public places than you would see in many private places. And there are many state and federal cases that that allow you that discretion. But I think with respect to this bill in particular, this speaker wants to add something.
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, there is an existing state statute, ORS 342-650, that specifically says no teacher in any public school shall wear any religious dress while engaged in the performance of duties as a teacher. Frankly, that was pointed out when the House considered and passed this bill 2 years ago. Originally, we did not have this exemption. That was added at the request of some school districts who were citing that particular statute. I will be very honest with you. I personally think this should apply more broadly, but I'm enough of an incrementalist that I think this will be an important step forward. And so basically, the provision in there that explicitly says this doesn't trump existing statute. That's why that section was added, to say it doesn't trump 342-650.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, because my only observation is the state university system, various schools, is allowing religious dress already in an academic public teaching environment, and we're saying it's not supposed to be, and so I'm just trying to make sure we avoid a class action. Because I have a broader interpretation. I'm with the speaker on this. It's like, yeah, it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander. Let's just do it.
No, without having the history on this, I'm assuming that there was some discussion at some point, maybe on that statute, when it was a bill regarding church and state, separation of powers, and such. But I guess we're not going to, let's say, approach that today. I do want to just get on the record, looking on page 2 of the bill, line 14, is one of the areas of that's supposed to be reviewed as a factor. And in that, it talks about the safety and health requirements of the facility, including the requirements for safety of other employees, etc. I want to make certain that if you have, let's say, some type of wardrobe that could actually put the employee at risk because of operating machinery that could actually get, the wardrobe could get caught in. Do you believe that that's wide enough, expanded enough to actually be able to be considered to make certain that you don't have a safety health risk for the employee, not just the employees around them?
Well, as Mr. Chair, committee, as we enforce this in the future, I would anticipate that that being a very strong factor in the undue hardship burden that the employer would be presenting as a reason why they would not have to accommodate. We certainly don't want anybody's physical health to be at risk at the workplace.
Right. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, you raised the issue there, and it struck me as workman's compensation, insurance costs, so on and so forth. I would assume that the commission would establish some administrative rules which give at least some initial guidance to employers should this be passed, because the first undue hardship would be having to spend weeks negotiating with your agency.
Okay.
It would be more costly than accommodating the individual.
Just a brief comment in response to Senator Boklas. Thank you, Mr. Chair, is that with regard to the school provision, I certainly can see that students at a higher education level in college could more easily perceive that the religious symbol or dress is that of the individual professor, whereas children in a elementary or K through 12 schools are more able to ascertain it as or perceive it as the school rather than the individual professor making a religious statement. So I can see a distinction there. I'm not sure that that's a legal distinction, but just in terms of of perception.
I perfectly agree, but the law says one thing and
understand.
We're saying another.
All right. Thank you all very much for being here. Our next panel is going to be the individuals from the Northwest Religious Liberty Association, Gregory Hamilton, Michael Peabody, Shani, and I can't, the last name I'm not sure, but based on how it's written, and Dave Miller.
Okay.
We made a lot of it. So let's just fix it.
Oh, and the there's a fourth person. If we can just bring another chair up so we can have all four of the panelists here. I apologize for not mentioning that earlier. And whatever presentation in order that you'd like to do, if you just give us your name before you give us your testimony, please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Greg Hamilton, President of the Northwest Religious Liberty Association. It's our privilege to be here with you this morning. Thank you for hearing us. I'm going to make a few brief statements, and I'm going to turn over the time to our distinguished colleague, Attorney Michael Peabody, to my right here, who's come all the way from Los Angeles. And so we're giving him the bulk of the time. And then we have a few real workplace situations, one with Shani Balverio, who, that's Balverio, anyway, Shani is situation that clearly is an example of discrimination in the workplace, and then David Miller, a trucker, will give you an idea of just the problems in the workplace, but an example of someone who's actually been accommodated. So we give you both views. My first comment, I'd like to just address really quickly that Section 4, which you guys have just discussed as sort of a tack on, as a natural transition. That that Oregon statute, in my opinion, this language is necessary because it merely acknowledges existing Oregon statutory law, which former Senator Brad Avakian mentioned, that permits religious dress in the Oregon public school arena unless such religious dress is deemed to be disruptive. So to me, that's a more accurate reading of what the statute is actually saying, with the amendment that's bolded where it says unless such religious dress is disruptive to the school environment. So I just want to make that clarification before we go any further. So it actually is more in harmony with this bill, which deals with accommodation and potential undue hardship, which a school can say, hey, this is a hostile situation. We deem this inappropriate. And so, you know, those questions, it creates an even balance in the public school system as well as in the private sector here regarding our bill. The Northwest Religious Liberty Association represents the constitutional and workplace discrimination concerns of all people of faith in the states of Alaska, Idaho, Montana, Oregon, and Washington. We are pleased, specifically with House Speaker Dave Hunt, who is sponsoring the Oregon Workplace Religious Freedom Act, a bill that passed the House in 2007 by a 68% margin during the 2007 legislative session. That was House Bill 3539A, the engrossed version. This, of course, was a tremendous moment for our organization and all people of faith, including religious minorities
Hamilton,
in the
I'm
state of Oregon.
I'm going to ask you not to read your testimony. To
okay.
summarize, because we do have a time
yeah.
limit with two
the,
of the bills.
The problem that we see is that in the workplace, we see a magic wand that is used often using undue hardship or the language of undue hardship to basically that gives employers a blank check, essentially, to say that this is a mere inconvenience to us to try to reschedule, and it's cost disruptive as well. And so that's the current Title VII standard, and that's the way it's been applied for a number of years. I had a call from Horizon Airlines from an attorney up in Seattle, the lead attorney there, on one of our mediation cases that says we don't have to accommodate anybody if we don't want to, because that's what Title VII says. It's an undue hardship, which is a de minimis standard, which says we can do whatever we want. Okay, that was really problematic to me. That was a real eye-opener to me, and it suggested to me that we needed a bill, not only in Oregon, but in Washington, to address this particular problem in Title VII law. And so we believe that the language of significant difficulty and expense is necessary to define what undue hardship is, to create a higher standard that doesn't necessarily put a heavy burden on employers, but a fair and reasonable burden that equals the playing field or balances the playing field between the protections that are provided in Title VII initially, or at least in the original intent of Title VII, both employees and employers. That balance was disrupted in a case called TWA versus Hardison in 1977 in the U.S. Supreme Court, and that has become the de minimis standard, which means you basically have little to no protection in the workplace for the employee, but giving virtually a blank check to employers has been problematic for a number of years, and so we're trying to address this with this bill. So at this time, I'd like to turn over my time to Attorney Michael Peabody, my distinguished colleague from Los Angeles, and thank you, Mike, for coming.
Thank you very much. My name is Michael Peabody. I'm an attorney in Los Angeles. I practice primarily employment defense and insurance defense, and I work with the law firm of Bradford and Barthel. I am here today because Title VII is essentially also duplicated here in Oregon. On my testimony, you can see the references to how that works, in case you're wondering how an attorney from Los Angeles is addressing the issue of undue hardship in Oregon. Now, what SB 786 does, and I actually analyze it from a defense perspective, is it provides a defensible framework for employers to use when making a decision whether or not to accommodate an employee. An employer is given a set of factors that they can go through, and the factors are listed in the bill. Things such as nature and cost of the accommodation, availability of resources, financial resources, the type of business operations, and safety and health. And they can look through these things and come up with a standard that they can defend, even at the outset before any litigation takes place, and they can say, here's why we could or could not accommodate. And the reason why they can be defended if they do decide to accommodate is sometimes the biggest pressure against accommodation comes not from the employer, but from coworkers who feel that they're being unfairly treated. So the employer can demonstrate, here is why we were able to accommodate. It will really reduce the amount of potential litigation. Again, as Greg Hamilton said, the undue hardship standard is very minimal. And many employers came away from, well, when Title VII was first introduced in the 1960s, there was a fairly high standard. Then the Supreme Court looked at what undue hardship meant, couldn't really make a decision, and said, well, it must be de minimis. What's the minimal amount of accommodation that is required to meet this goal? And they really drew a baseline that's the same for every corporation. So a company that's a small business or a large multi-billion-dollar corporation could cite the same amount of difficulty or expense and deny accommodation as a matter of policy. and simply say, look, we don't think we can accommodate without making that analysis. So what this bill would do is it would require employers to come to actually sit down and develop a brief, you know, or think through the process and be able to come up with something. I don't know if it will increase the amount of accommodation or not, but what it would do is reduce the amount of litigation. Bringing these cases is prohibitively expensive for a lot of law firms, and it's not really a cash cow for attorneys. Hence, I'm doing defense work. I have handled several of these cases in court on behalf of plaintiffs as well. But one thing that we often want to do, usually want to do in these cases, actually I'm going to say always, want to do in these cases is come to a peaceful resolution where the employer recognizes their responsibility to accommodate and does so. And I believe that SB 76 accomplishes this purpose.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you for traveling here today to give your testimony. So is it Valverio?
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
Mr. Chairman, committee, my name is Shani Valverio. I was recently employed as assistant manager in that position for approximately 3 to 4 years. Originally, I was accommodated with my needs to have sundown Friday to sundown Saturday off because of religious convictions. I was transferred to another store where the least of the difficulties was being held up to ridicule. I would work 10 to 14 hours with no breaks, no lunches, vacation time denied. When I got tired of that, requested to speak with the district manager. I was told, if you are scheduled to work on Saturday and you refuse, you will be terminated. When I attempted to reason with him, he said, if you don't work on Saturday, I will fire you. At that point, I contacted the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I also contacted Northwest Religious Liberty. They sent, Northwest Religious Liberty sent a letter to the manager and the district manager. Shortly after that, the situation seemed to resolve itself. However, a week, 10 days later, I came in early to my shift. I overheard the district manager speaking to the manager, saying, I just will not stand for this. I will get rid of her. Given the circumstances and knowing the other people working in the store, I have every reason to believe he was referring to me. I was transferred then to another store with no issues from that manager. However, there was continuing minor pressures from the district manager, culminating on the 11th of March, where I was told at the end of my shift I could not leave pending speaking with the district manager. When he arrived, he had my check and told me I was fired. There was no negotiation, no compromising at that point. I currently have an open case with the Bureau of Labor, a pending case with the Equal Employment Opportunity, and it's placed me in extreme financial hardship, which is affecting not only finances but medical issues. I believe that if the passing of Senate Bill 786 would make it easier for those with special or with religious needs to be accommodated. It would also make it more easy for the employers to accommodate without a reasonable financial or administrative hardship.
Thank you very much for coming forward. I know it's not easy for you to give this testimony at this point. I'm going to go ahead and hear from Mr. Miller, and then we'll ask the panel questions if there are any. Mr. Miller, if you could take the microphone and kind of just move it a little bit to you. There you go.
Yeah, my name is David Miller, and I'm a Seventh-day Adventist. And our religion, we believe that you don't work from sundown Friday night to sundown Saturday. And I started working for a trucking company in early 97, and I worked the dock for about 8 years, and I had the shifts that I had, I didn't have to worry about working Friday night. However, I became a driver, and that requires you to do overtime if you're out on the street. And the company basically started with talking to the terminal manager. I sent him a letter for asking for accommodation. This was in July of 06. Because sundown in October through February comes around 4:30. And he said, well, if I knew that you were going to bring this up as an issue, I would not have let you get into the driver training program. anyway, from that point on, it escalated. On Friday nights, I would work with some of the dispatch, and the new guys would work with me. I'd say, I'll work 14 hours a day, Monday through Thursday, if you get me off by sundown Friday night. And at this point, they have accommodated me, but for 3 or 4 months there, it was tough working with them.
All right.
And I urge you to pass Senate Bill 786.
Mr. Miller, also thank you for coming and telling your personal story. Is there any questions for our panel? The one thing I do want to ask Ms. Bolverio, I know that you're very cautious in how you put your statement together. I personally would like to know what the name of your employer is, since...
They own Burger King, Popeyes, Denny's, and I believe Del Taco. I was an assistant manager with Burger King.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. Again, thank you all very much. Mr. Peabody, thank you for traveling up here. I've got two other people that are scheduled to testify on this bill, J.L. Wilson and Stephen Green. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today besides those two gentlemen, if you all sit back, for Senate Bill 786? If you do, I need you to please go ahead and come on up.
J.L., why don't you get
go ahead and start.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Prozanski, members of the committee. For the record, J.L. Wilson representing Associated Oregon Industry. We are working in good faith with the Speaker's office to address our issues with the bill. The 786 is basically, as you've heard, an extension of Title VII protections down to the state level. We had concerns in three particular areas, which I'll address with the committee. The first of which is the Title VII protections include all companies of 15 employees or more at the federal level. 786 obviously applies down to employee number one. That's not something we're going to quibble with. I don't really see how you get a carve-out for certain employers in the bill based on size. The second issue, though, is the issue of reasonable accommodation. Unlike Title VII and current interpretation of Oregon law, Senate Bill 786 does not limit an employer's obligation to providing a reasonable accommodation. Reasonable is not, actually, that word is not in Senate Bill 786 at all. It mandates an employer provide just simply an accommodation, taking the reasonableness of any proposed accommodation out of the equation. An employee could demand an unreasonable accommodation, and an employer would be required to grant the accommodation unless it could satisfy the new higher bar for undue hardship that's put in Senate Bill 786. And then that leads me to the third issue, this issue of de minimis cost, which is the current federal standard for showing undue hardship, and the new undue hardship standards that are put in place with Senate Bill 86. I think you could argue both sides with a straight face. I would just give to your attention one federal case, which is Cloutier versus Costco, in which you had a woman who was a member of the United States Church of Body Modification who was employed by Costco, and she wanted to wear, you know, tattoos and rings, and Costco gave her the option of either wearing plastic inserts or covering them with flesh-covered bandages. Ultimately, the court cited in favor of Costco in this because it said that they did not have to grant Cloutier's preferred accommodation, but merely a reasonable one, which is why we think reasonable should be inserted in Senate Bill 786 to capture that sentiment. As it relates to a de minimis cost, one of the other findings of the Cloutier case was that, in fact, Costco had a right to control its public image. And to have somebody at a checkout stand that was adorned with tattoos and invisible facial piercings meant that Costco lost control of its public image, and that met the de minimis standard. That's something along those lines is not contemplated in Senate Bill 786, and I think maybe we should take a look at something along those lines. The Hardison case versus TWA, which was alluded to in prior testimony, at issue was a collective bargaining agreement. That is, Hardison had a collective bargaining agreement which TWA could not modify. Therefore, they couldn't change schedules around. And in the context of that collective bargaining agreement, Hardison could not work on Saturdays because that was a religious holy day. So something in the lines of taking into account collective bargaining agreements is something that may be included in the undue hardship standards. Those are our recommendations and our concerns. We certainly do not need to be met the whole way, but there are certain things in there that I think would make employers more comfortable with the application of the bill.
All right, thank you. Mr. Green, I'm going to let you go next. Also, saw your testimony, if you could just summarize.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Stephen Green. I'm a professor of law at Willamette University, and I direct Interdisciplinary Center on Religion, Law, and Democracy at Willamette. This is my area of expertise, church-state law. I've practiced and taught and written in this area for 20 years. I'm in support of this piece of legislation, and the reason that I am is because in my experience, you really don't see the government coming down and infringing upon people's religious liberties in the way that I think traditionally we think of free exercise of religion. Where the rubber hits the road most of the time is within situations where you have private employers or private landlords, etc., who are imposing some type of burden on the ability of people to engage in religious activity. And so this is, in many ways, is a religious liberty bill. Even though it deals with the workplace situation. As the speaker said, this bill is relatively narrowly targeted toward just accommodating religious needs with allowing people to be released for religious observances and then also to wear certain types of garb in the workplace. This does not create an absolute right for individuals to be accommodated. It provides a balancing test, one of those wonderful things we love in law school to talk about, and it basically means you should take into consideration various factors, which are all listed in the bill. Generally, though, that most legal experts from all sides of the spectrum, and I'm actually a progressive liberal on these issues, they all basically concur that the standard that the Supreme Court announced in the TWA versus Hardison test more or less gutted Title VII, and that it needs to be somehow strengthened because it does allow for employers to come forward with almost the most bare minimum response that really does not accommodate people's religious needs, and they basically win in those situations. There have been cases arising out of Oregon that have involved these exact issues dealing with people's inability to go to important religious observances or to wear actually relatively minimal type of religious garb, jewelry. And so this is just a small accommodation of people's religious needs. For some people who are not believers or the general populace, these may seem like insignificant things for them, but for individuals who really value their faith, sometimes these can be extremely important matters for them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nikki Terziev. I'm here for the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland this morning. I'll be very brief. We want to urge your support for this bill. We think it's been carefully crafted. We think it's been thoughtfully crafted, and we thank the speaker for bringing it forward.
Thank you. Any questions for anyone on the panel? First, it looks like Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Professor Green, you heard Mr. Wilson talk about the person from the U.S. Church of Body Modification, and I wonder, where is the analysis of what is a religion under this bill? At what point is that analysis done?
It's done at the what's called the prima facie case. It's done at the beginning where the claimant comes forward, and the claimant in all under current law and under this proposed law, the claimant would always have to make known to their employer that in fact they have a religious claim and there is a religious conflict. It's often a hard to know exactly whether some claims are valid or not. The courts have always allowed employers and courts to consider whether there is in fact a legitimate religious claim or it's just some type of bogus claim. My understanding is, though, and I'm sure the individuals in the Religious Liberty Association could speak to this more, that there really has not been a documentation of individuals just coming up with some arbitrary religious belief in order to get accommodated in these situations. Vast, vast, vast majority of situations are people who have no problem at all in establishing that this, in fact, is a long-standing religious tradition.
Thank you.
Any other Senator Boquist?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a comment for JL to take back when they're talking, and it kind of struck me on the driver situation that when discussions with Bowley and discussions with the Speaker's office, to ensure we at least raise the issue and make sure we bring other laws into this in terms of the discussion. What really strikes me is like hazardous material. If we have people that are dealing with hazardous materials and other things in the private sector, that we don't just leave them because the accommodation suddenly happens at this point in time and it moves on. I could see many cases, especially in the commercial driving side, where almost every truck has hazardous materials that we don't want to have left unattended or lose positive control of. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Pruszynski. Just a couple of points, Mr. Wilson. On the appearance part, I think that's very important, particularly in reception positions and so forth, where that receptionist is really the face of your contact with the public. And the second is when you talk, you're not willing to argue the point down to one employee. I would be willing to argue the point down to one employee, because there is no way that you can accommodate certain religious beliefs unless you want to work on Saturday yourself if you're an employer.
All right. Thank you all very much for coming forward. I'm going to go ahead and close the hearing on Senate Bill 786. Open up a public hearing on 807.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 807 allows a plaintiff to receive costs of medical monitoring for lung cancer in a tort case based on potential harm, requires plaintiff to stop smoking, it provides for a 2-year statute of limitations for bringing lawsuits after the effective date or after the risk of harm is discovered. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Chuck, it looks like you're going to lead off, and looks like and Don Austin. All right, let me just. Is Dr. Austin here as well? Is he not testifying?
He is supposed to be here. I don't see him here.
Okay.
Hopefully he will show up. He's an epidemiologist from the Oregon.
All right. Chuck, go ahead.
Health Science Center. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chuck Tauman. I'm a lawyer in Portland and have been involved both in the litigation end of tobacco enforcement and also in the public policy and legislative policy and of things. This is a bill involving a medical legal concept called medical monitoring. The definition of medical monitoring itself is somewhat evasive depending on whether you're talking about the medical context or the legal context. We're talking about the legal context, and it is a surveillance of medical conditions for people who have been put at an elevated risk of disease, not necessarily exhibiting symptoms of that disease, but a risk. And of course, we all know, without going through the statistics, as sometimes the tobacco company lawyers like to say, everyone knows that tobacco usage and exposure does create a elevated risk of disease, in particular lung disease. This bill is supported by the tobacco control community, the Tobacco Free Coalition of Oregon, and its constituent agencies. In fact, Dr. Austin is the head of the Oregon Public Health Association and was here to testify, or would be here to testify, on behalf of the Tobacco Free Coalition. The statistics for tobacco, the death and devastation for tobacco are well known. I'm not going to go over them. They're covered in the fact sheets that I've pointed out. But there is a solution, and the solution is medical monitoring. Now, the reason we're here today is that some colleagues and I, on behalf of a constituent actually of Senator Bonamici's, brought an action for medical monitoring against the tobacco companies that were selling the products that created the risk. That case went up to the Oregon Supreme Court, and last year in 2008, the court said, without commenting on any other aspect of the case, that in Oregon, any type of action, such as medical monitoring, where there is not a direct claim of a present injury, in other words, no one came in and said, I have lung cancer, I need help. What they said was, I've been put at an elevated risk of disease, in particular lung cancer. In such a situation, it's up to the legislature to authorize an action of this nature. And so that's why Senate Bill 807 was drafted and introduced, and that's why we're hoping for favorable consideration. The legal concept is this, and it's very familiar to practitioners, and that is that when a person or a company, an organization, a corporation, as part of its business, puts a product into the stream of commerce that causes injury, and in doing so acts unlawfully, and that's an important concept, acting unlawfully, when they do so, they should be responsible for the damages and injuries that result. In this case, we're not talking about an actual physical injury. We're talking about a risk, an elevated risk of injury. And if you look at the websites of Philip Morris and Reynolds American, which now comprises R.J. Reynolds and Brown and Williamson, and Lorillard, you'll see that each of them acknowledges that their products cause their consumers, when the product is used as it is intended to be used, an elevated risk of disease. So there's no dispute about that. The question of whether their conduct was unlawful in doing so is a question that has to be resolved by a fact finder. Of course, the industry claims that their conduct has been lawful. As many of you know, I've just completed a 10-year process in which we tried to establish that at least the conduct of Philip Morris was in fact unlawful and required some form of accountability, and that litigation has recently come to a conclusion. So for those of you who are looking for CLE credits for this, the case involved is Lowe versus Philip Morris. It's at 344 Oregon 403, 2008. And it basically covers what we all learned, or those of us who went to law school learned, and that is that there are four basic levels of proof, elements of proof, in establishing, in this case, a negligence case, but it works for any type of unlawful conduct, and that is a duty, a breach of duty, the causation, and damages. And it's really this last element that is substituted, risk of damage, is substituted for damage by the legislature in this case. What this does is open the courthouse door for people who have this elevated risk to shift the costs of surveillance, of medical surveillance, medical monitoring, to the people who are actually making the profit in selling the product. It does not create a mandate. And that's very important to note. There are no dollars changing hands. There's no state involvement in terms of any fiscal aspect to this bill. What it does is it opens the courthouse door, which has thus far been closed to people making this type of medical monitoring claim. Now, in addition, because we didn't want people to see this as a license to continue smoking, if they got a clean bill of health, it is required, or I should say the court may require as a part of this, that an individual to be a class member must have either quit smoking in the past or be enrolled in some type of smoking cessation program. Thus, the cost of both the medical monitoring, which is currently borne by the individual, by private health insurance, or by the Oregon Health Plan, that cost is shifted to those who are making the profit through the sale of the product. Secondly, the cost of smoking cessation, which is currently another state burden through the Tobacco prevention and education program of the Department of Health and Human Services, or the Department of Human Services, is born at least in part as to those who qualify for the medical monitoring program by private funds, funds from the very corporations who are creating the risk. So there's a sense of fairness here, and the fairness involves both the ability of the tobacco industry to contest this. There is, as I said, there is no mandate. The tobacco industry can and certainly will. I see that several lawyers from the tobacco industry are signed up to testify. They certainly will contest this. They will contest whether their conduct has been unlawful. They will contest whether their conduct actually caused an increased risk. And they will contest whether medical monitoring is the appropriate medically necessary remedy. And that's their right to do. No one is trying to take that away from them.
Chuck, I'm going to need you to start wrapping up so I can get the next panel on.
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The point here is, and the point that I really want to make, is about litigation, because I've heard from more than one of you that the specter of litigation is what is holding a bill like this back. And I want to say this, that litigation is how the rights that the legislature gives and the responsibilities that they give to Oregonians is how those rights and responsibilities are enforced. And to be fearful of litigation, to have it be some kind of specter, is, in a sense, it diminishes the work that the legislature does. And so those of you who are concerned about opening the door to the floodgates of litigation, this bill does not do that. But more importantly, having litigation means that the rights that you give to Oregonians and the responsibilities that you give to Oregonians are in fact being enforced. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. All right, I got people jumping. I'm going to start with Senator Wissett and then Senator Bonamici. Okay.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, and thank you for the lecture. Is the act of using the product equally unlawful in your mind, then?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wissett, I'm not sure what equally unlawful
Let me rephrase the question. You're saying that you're suggesting that it's unlawful to provide the product. Is it equally unlawful to choose to use the product to cause harm to your body?
I believe that there is responsibility on the part of the smoker or other consumer for using the product. And we address that in two ways. One is that as in all litigation, I'm sure you're familiar, there's a process by which the fact finder, judge or jury, actually compares the responsibility, the personal responsibility of the, in this case, the tobacco company with the smoker.
I'm familiar with that procedure. I ask you, do you believe, is the act of using the product equally unlawful as to providing the product?
Well,
just a yes or no answer, sir.
No, I don't.
Okay, thank you.
And the reason is that it's not unlawful to use the product unless you are under 18, so that's lawful, and it's not unlawful to sell the product.
Second question is, would this bill, if passed, create a precedent for civil liability without demonstrating injury in Oregon, according to the Supreme Court decision?
I'm sorry. I partly didn't hear the question. If you could repeat it, I would appreciate it.
Would this bill, if passed, establish a precedent for civil liability without demonstrating injury within Oregon?
Yes. Thank you. In the sense that the Oregon Supreme Court defined injury as a present physical manifestation of the injury, this would change that law. And that's why we're here, Senator. Thank you.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you. Chuck, it's my understanding that I know Senator Wissett asked about a precedent, but it's my understanding that medical monitoring is done in other areas other than tobacco use. Could you explain those things?
Well, specifically when we're talking, medical monitoring, of course, as a medical concept, is done on a continual basis by individual doctors and clinics and hospitals and things like that. Medical monitoring in the sense that we're talking about now, where it's a legal remedy, is done both in in many other states that have passed laws or have recognized under the common law the right to have medical monitoring, and also in different exposure areas. Lead and asbestos come to mind, and then there are two other states that have recognized in the litigation context tobacco medical monitoring, West Virginia and Louisiana.
Thank you. And a follow-up?
Yes.
Mr. Chair. And can you talk a little bit about what's the cost of the monitoring? It's my understanding it's like a spiral CAT scan, and do you have a sense of what that costs?
Thank you, Senator Chair Prozanski, Senator Bonamici. It's hard to pinpoint the cost. The CT scans are one element of medical monitoring and the most advanced, and they generally cost between $200 and $300 each. But done on the kind of scale that we're talking about here, as they have been done in other states, that cost can be reduced significantly.
All right, Chuck, a couple things as a follow-up from what I just heard. My understanding is the two states that have actually, where court decisions were based on common law, correct?
That's correct.
And Oregon does not recognize this as a common law
remedy? Mr. Chair, that is correct.
And then regarding your other statement, which kind of caught me off guard, was the, from what I've heard from other, let's say, opponents, is on the medical monitoring as to legislation that's been passed. I thought I heard you say that numerous states have actually passed legislation that does provide for medical monitoring. Could you please provide us, not now, but a list of what those are and what areas they'll actually cover?
I'd be happy to. I have it in my file now, and I'd be happy to provide that to you.
If you put it in written form so we can have it, that would be
absolutely
great.
Absolutely.
There's questions?
Yes. A follow-up to your question, Mr. Chair, if you would kindly indulge me when you send that information back, could we identify which states allow the smoker to continue smoking in? Is their law similar to what we have, or is it a prohibition against smoking and then they can be monitored?
Thank you very much. I'll include that. Thank you.
Thank you for your time and your testimony. Bill Gary, Bill, I understand you're going to be leading off with Mr. Gardner on this. I have room for, we can bring him another chair if you have two other people you want to bring up. The others seem to be more in support of the positions I think you're going to be testifying to.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today for Altria Client Services and its affiliates, including Philip Morris USA. I'm not going to read my testimony, which is please oppose Senate Bill 807, and I'm not even going to summarize it. I'm merely going to draw the committee's attention to the breadth of opposition to this bill, which spans virtually every sector of the Oregon economy. Mr. Gary will testify as to why this bill is so strongly opposed by virtually every sector of the Oregon business community. Thank you.
Thank you. Bill?
Chair Krasinski, members of the committee, I'm Bill Gary. I'm a lawyer, practice with the law firm of Harang Long, Gary Rudnick. Senate Bill 807, as Mr. Tomlin said, would permit a plaintiff to bring a civil action based on the use of tobacco or exposure to tobacco without proving the existence of a present injury. This would be a dramatic change in the law of torts. The requirement that a plaintiff seeking to recover from another for a wrongful act prove the existence of a present injury has a long pedigree. It's really about 500 years old and traceable to early English common law. And to dispense with that requirement would be a fairly dramatic shift. Senate Bill 807 would make that shift without providing any standards. It doesn't say how much of an increased risk is required. It doesn't say that the medical monitoring tests must be shown to be medically necessary or reasonable, so one could obtain relief under this bill even if no physician, responsible physician, would prescribe the medical monitoring regime that the plaintiff seeks. I was counsel of record in the Lowe case that Mr. Tomlin mentioned at the appellate level. I argued the case on behalf of all of the defendants, And in that case, three different courts, starting with the trial court, then a three-judge panel of the Court of Appeals, and finally a six-member Supreme Court, all unanimously concluded that the claim failed because the plaintiff failed to allege the existence of a present injury, and a present injury is a prerequisite to bringing a tort claim under Oregon law. There was no dissent from that because the conclusion was fairly unremarkable. Oregon law has been well settled on that point for over 150 years. And the national trend, Mr. Tommen mentioned two things that I found surprising. He said many courts have adopted a medical monitoring remedy. In fact, six out of the last seven Supreme Courts from states that have considered it have rejected it. It was adopted in Louisiana, but the legislature subsequently overruled the Supreme Court on that point. And he also said that legislatures have adopted medical monitoring remedies similar to the bill that's before you. I'm not aware of any state legislature who has ever adopted a bill remotely close to this one. In fact, the only action that I'm aware of that has been taken legislatively is the Louisiana legislature, which precluded a medical monitoring remedy in the absence of a present injury, and a court that a state that, I think it was New York, that provided for some study of the subject. Senate Bill 807 actually goes further than what the case in Lowe would have done. In Lowe, the plaintiff sought to represent a class of what the plaintiff's lawyers estimated would be 400,000 Oregonians who were smokers that met the definition of the class, and asked the court to set up a court-monitored and supervised program of medical monitoring that would have, I believe, been the largest public health program in the history of the state of Oregon. Mr. Tommen said there is no cost associated with this bill. Believe me, there's a cost associated with the impact that it would have on the judiciary. The judiciary is not equipped to deal with the establishment and supervision of the kinds of public health programs that would be possible under this bill. And in fact, I would submit that it is the role of the legislature to establish those public health programs and the role of the executive to oversee them, not the role of the judiciary. And to expand civil liability in the way that this bill would have a truly profound effect on the judiciary at a time when they're struggling with limited resources like everybody else. The plaintiff in Lowe sought a court-supervised program. This bill would simply provide that a plaintiff can recover the cost of medical monitoring, which I believe would make it an element of damages, which means the plaintiff could put that money in his or her pocket and not actually obtain the monitoring that is the objective of this bill. All in all, and one other thing I want to mention is that Mr. Tommen spoke about the cigarette manufacturers as the target of this bill. The way the bill is drafted, it is not limited to cigarette manufacturers. The corner grocery store that sells cigarettes, the bar that until last year allowed people to smoke within it, even the roommate who smoked cigarettes would be potential defendants under this lawsuit. And any of the 400,000 people that would have been members of the class in Lowe could direct their lawsuit at any of those businesses or individuals. And of course, Mr. Tommen made an important statement when he said that this would establish a precedent. And it's a precedent that I think is very dangerous. It's a small step, great leap to go from requiring a present injury to basing the system on increased risk. It is a small step from there to expand it to the people that sell us our gasoline for our cars, or the people that make or sell our food, or the liquor industry, wine, beer, etc. And it's difficult to see what the difference is in those kinds of industries, and I think it would be a logical next step if this step were taken to expand it in that way, and I think that's why you will see widespread opposition to this, not just from the tobacco industry, but from the business community in Oregon as a whole. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
I have a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gary, what I'm struggling with is figuring out the what causes and constitutes an injury. And we're talking about enhanced risk. And so what I'm trying to figure out, and I read the opinion a while back, but what I'm trying to figure out is at what point would the enhanced risk, in your opinion, constitute an injury? Because it doesn't say that an enhanced risk could never be an injury. And so what if, for example, the smoker constantly got pneumonia or had some sign that there was cancer developing? When does that become an injury that's actionable?
Senator Bonamici, it's a difficult philosophical question at the fringes about when a risk becomes a present injury. This bill makes it pretty simple because it says any increased risk. What the Supreme Court mentioned in rejecting the plaintiff's claim was that the plaintiff in that case did not allege that it was substantially certain that she would develop lung cancer, and the suggestion, I think, was that if you could allege a substantial certainty of some injury occurring, that might be a different case. But it only becomes difficult at the fringes, and what this bill would do is really transform the system and say it doesn't require a present injury. Any increased risk is sufficient to give rise to a cause of action.
Thank you. And follow up? So for clarification, there could be a time when it's not saying necessarily that it would change the law so that you wouldn't have to show an injury. It would change the law to say, At some point, there's an enhanced risk that constitutes an injury.
Well, I think Mr. Tallman said this bill would change the law so that you don't have to prove an injury. You gave an example of somebody that has recurring cases of pneumonia or other kinds of symptoms as a result of the use of tobacco. And I think I would concede that if somebody has physical symptoms, there is an injury within the meaning of existing law, and therefore they would be able to state that element of their cause of action.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Now I've got five individuals that are all lobbyists that are here with wanting to give them testimony and objection or against the bill. It looks like everyone besides JL has given written testimony, so I'm not going to say you can't come up here and give us your testimony, but at the same time, as we all know, it's all part of the record. So is there any of the five who want to come up and put anything on the record that's not going to be included within the written testimony? Thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead. Is there anyone else besides those five who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 807? Not, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. Thank you very much. And we're going to move into the other two bills that we have. What I want to do is we have Chief Judge Dave Brewer here. I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 262.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 262 is a gut-and-stuff bill. There is a -1 amendment and allows judges to sit in panels of two to hear and decide cases, allows pro tem judges. The chief judge is allowed to delegate the authority to rule on motions and issue orders and procedural matters to an appellate commissioner, and now limits de novo review. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you, Chair Prasansky, and members of the committee for making time available to consider this matter today. I want to thank Mr. Bill Taylor and Ms. Braun for the invitation to the Judicial Department to submit what we have described as efficiency legislation this session. SB 262 is a proposed efficiency legislation for the Court of Appeals. SB 256, which is the second bill, is broader for the entire branch. This invitation was specifically made in connection with the budget situation and expected cuts that would occur to all the branches of government, including the judiciary. And we were asked to look at it as an opportunity to consider procedural efficiencies across the board that might help the court in various respects.
Dave?
Yes?
I, as one of our members, doesn't believe you identified yourself with the record, so could you just do that?
I apologize. Dave Brewer, Chief Judge for the Court of Appeals. I'm so sorry. Thank you very much. I apologize to you for that oversight. Just quickly, Chair Przanski, to set the table, our court per case per judge is probably the busiest intermediate appellate court in the United States, yet we do have a number of procedural devices that are consistent with a court that is not nearly as busy. We are one of two courts in the United States that has de novo review in every single equity case. What that means is the court considers the case as if it were the judge or the judge sitting there as the trial court on a record, as opposed to with live witnesses in front of it, and in certain classes of cases reviews the evidence from top to bottom. Just the opposite of what we would do in a jury trial, where the standard is we will uphold a finding of fact if it's based on evidence in the record. So very few states still have universal de novo review. The amendments to ORS 19.415 would make the exercise of de novo review discretionary for the court, and we would propose to adopt an Oregon Rule of Appellate Procedure that would outline how we would exercise that discretion. What I would indicate to you is the problems we've had typically in de novo review, where we just don't get it, is where the trial court makes conclusions of law but doesn't make findings of fact that seem to match up with it in any way. And so our suggestion would be that by rule of appellate procedure, we explain, for example, that if the court's conclusions don't appear to match up with the facts, the court may then exercise de novo review. There are a couple of exceptions, Chair Przanski, members of the committee, that we think are appropriate. One, identified by legislative counsel, Mr. Hendricks, are some statutes where, because of the peculiarity of the nature of the review, de novo review would still probably be appropriate, because any evidence review, which is the jury standard, doesn't make any sense. And those statutes, I won't go into them in detail, are set out in various subsections of the bill. I reviewed those. I agree with Mr. Hendricks. Those are appropriate exceptions. The other exception that we are proposing is termination of parental rights, because of the tremendous importance of that area of case law and our belief that the legislature wants us to have de novo review in that area of the law, and we certainly support that. We are proposing to accept termination of parental rights and maintain de novo review in those cases. So this would put us in the mainstream of courts around the country. It would not put us as an outlier. It recognizes what most courts already do, particularly in this budget climate. We think it's appropriate. It would involve cost avoidance as a fiscal impact, not true cost savings, because, frankly, the court probably could support having at least three more panels of three judges already in order to do its work. That's our basic proposal regarding the amendment to ORS 19.415. The other amendments are threefold. They're to ORS 2.570. They would allow the court to have up to two out of three judges be pro tem or senior judges. We typically use retired Supreme Court justices or retired Court of Appeals judges in our pro tem panel. We occasionally use sitting trial judges or retired trial judges, but we've never used anyone outside the judiciary. It would also allow the court to follow a model that's been adopted in New Jersey to allow certain cases to be decided at the court's discretion in two-judge panels and bring a third judge in only to break a tie. These two measures are not things that we're, embracing with open arms, because we actually do believe that the proper general rule would be to have at least two elected judges on each panel and to decide cases in three-judge panels. We also recognize that in an environment where we're looking at cuts up to 15% to 20%, and we're all already struggling to keep up with our caseload, that we have to propose some efficiency measures, and before actually implementing those, decide wisely about whether to do that. We're simply seeking the authority to do it if we need to at this point as things unfold. The final part of ORS 2.570, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that we're proposing to add is to recognize the motions commissioner position that the court already has.
We're currently operating a motions department, which Mr. Jim Nass, I'll just ask him to stand, is the court's motion commissioner. We're following a model that was adopted a number of years ago by the Washington Court of Appeals. It is being used very effectively, where the commissioner, Mr. Nass, has worked for the judicial department for over 20 years, helping us with motions. And the commissioner initially can make rulings on motions to be reviewed by the court. And so parties have a right of review. We think it would probably be a good idea also to ask the legislature to recognize that practice. So this would be more of a belt and suspenders approach, because we believe we have authority under our current administrative authority in managing the court. There's a right of review. There still would be a right of review by a three-judge panel. We've been using Mr. Nass in this role for a year and a half. We've only had about five or six requests for reviews of his orders. They've all been upheld by the court. So this would not involve no change in existing practice. I won't repeat, Mr. Chair, any of the rest of my testimony, but I stand ready to answer any questions or add anything that would be useful to the committee in regard to these bills. We thank you for your consideration.
All right, thank you very much. Questions? Dave.
Just quickly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Burr, just logistically on the bringing a third judge in, if you need that judge to break a tie, then do you have to start over again? I'm just trying to figure out how this works, because you don't know in advance that it's going to be a tie, apparently, and how does that work?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, that's a great question. I talked to my colleague, Judge Ed Stern, who's the chief judge of the New Jersey Court of Appeals, and I said, Ed, how in the heck do you make this work? They very rarely have a tie in the kinds of cases that these panels are used in New Jersey. It happens apparently less than 1% of the time. It's typically used for certain kinds of criminal cases, post-conviction prisoner litigation cases. So that doesn't happen very often. When it does, the case is resubmitted. And so they view it as a substantial net effect cost savings, because it's very rarely used. I wouldn't ever want to do that unless the judge came in and heard oral argument, and so we would do a resubmission.
Thank you.
I think the judge may have just answered my question, but Judge Brewer, you would not be doing this on a de novo review then?
Chair Przanski, Senator Whitsitt, you are correct.
Thank you.
Senator Boquist.
Okay, Mr. Chair, because that came to my office and statements, I need to go back to what Senator Bonamici and Senator Whitsitt said. If you could just reconfirm, in the case of a tie, the third judge wouldn't come in and look at all the records and make a whatever determination you call this thing. Mm-hmm. The third judge would actually come in and the panel would start over, is what you're saying, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, the answer is yes.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your time.
All right. Was there anyone else who want to give testimony on Senate Bill 262? Not seeing anyone. I'm closing the public hearing on 262. I'm going to go ahead and open up our public hearing on the last bill that we have scheduled today, Senate Bill 256. And what I'm going to do is make a change of order. I know that we have a panel of four individuals who more than likely wouldn't be coming here on a regular basis. So we're going to take your testimony, even though it is an against, and instead of hearing the proponent first, so we can get it on the record, because I'll probably be going to have Mr. Miller come back tomorrow. Mr. Miller, stay put. Don't leave yet. Council, go ahead and give us an overview.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 256 revises statutory authority for Oregon Judicial Department in effort to streamline operations. I'm not going to read my whole SMS.
Thank you very much.
You.
All right, I've got a panel of four, and so we'll need to bring another chair up. And it appears Terry Munt, Robin Nolan, Mary Fagan, and Deborah Cheney.
Sheen,
excuse me. And I hate to rush you, but I'm going to tell you we've got about 10 minutes. And I'd like to, I have one other piece of business I'd like to try to take care of if we can.
Okay. Ready? Okay. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, thank you very much for taking the time to hear us this morning. My name is Terry Munt. I'm a registered professional reporter and a certified reporting instructor. I worked for 25 years as a freelance court reporter and a court reporting firm owner. I'm now retired from the practice. I'm a member of the Oregon Court Reporters Association and presently serve as chair of the Student Liaison Committee. I oppose SB
policy 256-2 because I strongly believe that court reporters are...
I'm going to ask all of you that have gotten written testimony.
Okay.
We're all going to read it, so if you could just summarize your opposition, the key points, that'd be great.
The key point is that court reporters need to be certified so that the public is assured that they have a competent person taking down the record. The court reporter is the one unbiased person involved in the proceedings and the person who is responsible for keeping the record. All of the states surrounding Oregon have mandatory certification. Oregon's is just voluntary, and it is really vital to the profession that we maintain the standards that we have. I worked on writing writing the rules that we have when the law was adopted, and it has worked very well for us. And with our advisory committee advising the Department of Justice when they have any questions. Also, on the financial issue, we certainly understand the need for cutting down expenses in our state, and we do have proposals. When the law was originally passed, we had set the fee for court reporters to be certified at $100 a year, and that was when we were under the Bureau of Labor and Industries. When it was moved from Boley to the Department of Justice, for some reason, when it was decided that the renewal would be every other year instead of every year, the doubling of the fee was overlooked. So it's now $100 every other year. All of the court reporters are certainly willing and have asked to have the fee raised to $100 per year. It's always been our intention that this program be self-supporting. We also, the Oregon Court Reporters Association is ready and willing to take over the testing, which is a big part of the expense, and we can do that at no expense to the state. We have a lot of experience with our national association doing testing. So thank you for your time. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer.
Okay, I'm going to take other testimony. Okay. I have one question I'm going to ask the panel once you have a chance to supplement what's already been said.
My name is Robin Nodland. I'm a court reporter, freelance firm owner. I'm also currently a member of the CSR Advisory Committee, which this section 21 through 25 reveals the language in the code for the committee. And my concern is, so I have that hat on today, but also it appears to weaken the overall bill and or the code and take out shalls and put in may so that there is no bones to this, to real strength to our CSR anymore. As a member of the CSR Advisory Committee, I can attest to our activity. Mary Fagan's on the committee also, and Kathy Monahan. We advise the committee, the state court administrator and staff. From a reporter's perspective, when issues come up, we recently, years ago, we got together and updated the rules and had input and work sessions. This is all done on a voluntary basis. There's no cost to the state for the advisory committee for our role. We communicate via email, phone calls. We have a member present at every state test. We're there. We had a test last year where we were not invited to attend, and there were problems, serious problems, and they scheduled another test. They weren't going to have the second test that year, but they had to because of the dissatisfaction with the test takers. Had a CSR advisory committee person been there, we would, reporters know you can't have a test, give a test with train tracks where a train was going by. It's 5 minutes of testimony that reporters have to get with 95% accuracy. It's like a performance. So having a CSR advisory committee is vital to the running of the CSR program. As Terry said, Washington, Idaho, and California have mandatory CSRs. We have voluntary CSR, and we are very diligent in educating our clients and the deponents that we are certified, and that holds us to certain standards and rules and ethics.
people who are not CSRs aren't held to any standards. And so it's incumbent on us to make sure that people know that we're the only state that has that. People that can't pass tests in other states can come to Oregon and work.
Okay.
Another provision of the Senate bill is it repeals the section about the test speed requirements. The CSR currently has levels of 225 words per minute for the Q&A, and that is minimum entry level. And so that really concerns me if we're going to pull out any speed requirements on test taking. People get out of school with these tests, and to work in court, to work in the legal setting, you really need to use that as a baseline and keep increasing your speed. There's some language in there that appears to try to bring the reporters and interpreters into some type of parity, and I feel that's apples and oranges. Interpreters interpret based on to make the deponent understand, the witnesses understand. In court reporters, we're verbatim. There is no interpretation. There is no room for us to get the gist of it and pass it along. So thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you for your testimony.
Chair Pazanski and members of the committee, my name is Mary Fagan. I'm currently an official court reporter, and I am the legislative chair for the Oregon Court Reporters Association. My two colleagues have pretty much covered everything I would have said, except for the fact that I will say I have been before you to testify when we had the loss of official court reporter positions, and there's now law that allows private stenographic reporters to come in, and they shall be certified. And so we're just opposed to any kind of weakening of the certification program, especially since we're possibly ready to lose the remaining 8 official court reporters that we've got. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Pazanski, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, I have not submitted any written testimony. Good morning. Thank you for allowing us this time. My name is Deborah Sheen. I'm currently the president of Oregon Court Reporters Association, of which we have several members here. And I'm just here this morning to testify on behalf of OCRA in opposition to SB 256-2, sections 21 through 25. Over 75% of our state association members have earned the distinction of the certification of the Oregon CSR. And the statutorily mandated CSR program is important to a large majority of our membership. We represent close to 200 court reporters in the state. And we have, since the early 80s, attempted to have the CSR mandatory instead of voluntary. But for us, it's very important that the judicial system have transcripts that reflect very accurate transcript for 12,500 members of our Oregon State Bar. And we just do not want to see that CSR program weakened. And we are fully cognizant of Oregon's current economic climate, and we are agreeable with the fee section being taken out of the statutory language to allow greater flexibility in setting reasonable fees and exploring the possibility of substituting the current national testing program in place of the state test. OCI remains committed to working with the Judicial Department to discuss cost-conscious measures which will keep the program strong and protect the legal community and our judicial system. Thank you so much for your time.
All right, thank you. Let me do this for committee members. We're just about 10 o'clock. If you need to take off, feel free to do so. Deborah, you covered a point that I was going to just bring up, because my understanding in speaking to the proponents of this is one of the safeguards that we would have is a requirement that still would be the national certification program of having that as the means to make certain we still have that high standard. And I'd like if you could, one of you, give us some overview as to whether you think that would be acceptable to in the sense of the standard they have would be to the level that we currently have.
Yes. So the National Court Reporters Association, their entry-level test is the Registered Professional Reporter, which has the same speed test. That is also a voluntary test. That is, and largely when they wrote the bill, a lot of the, so the speeds and also the ethical obligations mirrored the national standard. The reason it's important to have a state CSR program, even if it just subsumes that, if they take that test as the CSR test, that works fine, and they've done that in other states. So, you know, that eliminates the cost of the test. But it's still important to have a state test and certification so that your members are held to a standard here in the state.
So kind of a code of conduct that you would have Correct. Within the association.
Correct.
All right, any other questions for this panel? I want to thank you all very much for hanging in with us, and I'm glad we got your testimony in and your excuse. Thank you. What I'm going to do this, folks, we have three people that are scheduled to testify on this bill, and that's Bruce Miller, Brad Berry, and Paul Snyder. At this point, what I'm going to do is I'm going to have this bill carried over for those three individuals to come forward tomorrow to give us testimony. If you need to put in written testimony, that will be fine. So we're going to carry Senate Bill 256 over till tomorrow and take testimony from those three. Is there anyone else that's here in the audience today who planned or wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 256? All right, so that's going to be the limits that we're going to set for tomorrow, because I know we're having a pretty full docket tomorrow. So those three individuals will be allowed to testify tomorrow. We'll leave the record open on this one to go ahead and take more testimony in writing. And then the last thing I'm going to do, if y'all are willing to hang in there for a couple of more minutes, first let me close the Senate Bill 256. And I'm going to need to put on the record that we have Senate Bill 389 that's going to be carried over until tomorrow. We're going to also carry over Senate Bill 945. And 945 is going to be carried over until Monday, this next Monday, which I believe is the 13th of April. And so the intent is next Monday, but I believe it's the 13th. And then we have two bills that are ready for a work session, and I'm wondering if we want to go ahead and get those done now, or do you want to wait till tomorrow? All right, let's go ahead and move them now.
Okay.
Which one do you have?
On Senate Bill 48.
We'll open up work session on Senate Bill 48.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 48 has a -4 amendment, and this was in front of the committee before, was March 9th, and we discussed the -1 amendment, and the -1 amendment changed the original bill and made this into a licensing bill instead of a criminal bill. So if a teacher is found or someone who has a teaching license is found to have been guilty of rape, sodomy, sexual penetration, or sexual abuse by the TSPC by a preponderance of the evidence, then that would bar their application or reapplication for a state teaching's license. The -4 amendment just makes a little bit of kind of technical changes working with their counsel, their general counsel, except I want to point out that it does take out the authority for the criteria that the teacher had to have authority over the student before this kicks in. So it could be a teacher visiting another school, or it could be whoever else is licensed. So I wanted to point that out to the committee. This is ready to move. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Senator Boquist.
Move the -4 into 48.
Senator Boquist moves the -4 into Senate Bill 48. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 48 as amended by the -4 to the floor with the two pass.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 48 as amended by the -4 to the floor with a dual pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I haven't really had time to look through this amendment, and on the basis of that, I will support it here today, yes.
All right. Senator Westett reserves his right to, let's say, not support the bill on the floor if so needed. Any other motions, or not motions, any more statements for the record? If not, then it passes. And then the last, I'm going to go ahead and close the, and I'll be the carrier on 48. And the last bill that we're going to take care of is work session open on House Bill 2275A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2275A comes to you from the Department of Justice, clarifies that a person eligible for and receiving assistance pursuant to Title 4A of the Social Security Act is presumed not able to pay child support. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have the -2 amendments in front of you, which allows the Attorney General to declare a period of significant unemployment, as we have now, and allows the Support Enforcement Division during a period of significant unemployment to suspend or modify a support enforcement order. Mr. Members of the committee, the significance of moving this bill is really in the -2 amendments, even though it is a House bill, because this will allow them to go out and modify support orders. There's a presumption now that you can always find a minimum wage job, and that was true up until recently. That doesn't always apply now. So this will give them the ability to modify child support orders where someone cannot find a job, even a minimum wage job. No fiscal, no revenue.
My understanding that we need to move the dash twos to accomplish this.
I think, Mr. Chair, we've already adopted
them. Okay. Mr. Chair, I was the only person that had a question, which is why we didn't move it. So I'll move 2275 as amended with the dash twos to the floor with the due pass.
House Bill 2275A as amended by the dash two amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And do I have a carrier for this one? Senator Boquist volunteers, and he'll be our carrier. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2275A, and colleagues will be here tomorrow morning at 8:30. Thank you very much for hanging in there.